Welcome to the Deep Dive, the show where we slice through the noise of daily information overload and bring you the crucial insights that genuinely make you well-informed. I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Taylor Johnson. Always great to be here.
Today, we're doing a deep dive into the Federal Register for Thursday, August 14th, 2025.
Right.
Now, for those of you who might not spend your mornings, you know, poring over government documents, and let's be honest, that's most of us. The Federal Register is basically the daily journal of the U.S. government.
Yeah, think of it like the official newspaper for federal agencies.
Exactly. It's the official publication where all the daily business of the federal government gets printed. This includes everything from proposed regulations that might become law, to final rules that are law, presidential documents like executive orders, and all sorts of agency notices.
A real mix of things.
A real mix. And our mission today is to cut through all that legalese and, frankly, dense bureaucratic language to bring you the most important nuggets of knowledge and insight from this specific day's publication. It's your shortcut to truly understanding what's moving the gears of government right now.
Mm-hmm.
And trust me, today's Register holds some truly fascinating developments. We'll touch on everything from aviation safety, critical healthcare policy, environmental protection, even the future of city governance.
It covers a lot of ground.
It really does. And just to set the stage a bit more, the Federal Register serves as this uniform system for making regulations and legal notices available to the public. It's published every weekday, Monday through Friday, by the Office of the Federal Register, that's part of the National Archives.
The nation's record keeper, essentially.
Precisely. Ensuring these public documents are officially archived and accessible. You can find it online, which is how most people access it these days. And here's a key point. Its contents are judicially noticed.
Right. And that's not just legal jargon. It means courts can officially acknowledge the content without needing formal proof because it is the public record. It carries real legal weight.
So these aren't just dry documents collecting dust.
Not at all. They are literally the gears and levers of government in action. They reflect significant policy shifts, economic adjustments, crucial safety updates, things that impact every aspect of our lives. Mm-hmm. From the food we eat, the planes we fly on, even the air we breathe.
Is where policy ideas become reality.
Exactly. It's where abstract concepts turn into concrete rules affecting people on the ground. And today, we're going to uncover some surprising facts, I think, and connect some dots across areas that might seem totally unrelated at first glance.
Okay, let's dive in. We'll start by unpacking some of the significant rules published today. These are rules already in effect. First up, we're heading to the Department of Agriculture.
Mm-hmm. This first one, it might sound a little like bureaucratic housekeeping, but it actually shows how the government tries to, you know, streamline its own processes, which ultimately impacts the people they serve.
Right. This is a final rule from the Federal Crop Insurance Corporation and the Risk Management Agency, both part of USDA. It's effective today, August 14th, 2025. And its main purpose is part of this bigger ongoing effort to reduce regulatory burdens and costs across the government.
Trying to cut down on red tape?
Essentially, yes.
Yeah.
Specifically, they're removing two outdated sections from the Code of Federal Regulations dealing with agriculture. One section covered something called Prevented Planting Supplemental Disaster Payments. These were extra funds for farmers who couldn't plant insured crops because of disaster conditions.
Okay.
The other eliminated rule dealt with the Pandemic Cover Crop Program. That program offered premium support to farmers during the 2021 and 2022 crop seasons.
So think of it like, you know how you might have old instruction manuals for appliances you don't even own anymore? This is kind of like the government cleaning out its regulatory closet. These programs were valuable back then, but their time has passed. So removing the rules formally acknowledges they're obsolete. For farmers, or anyone tracking agricultural policy, this specific change doesn't affect anything current.
Right, it's backward looking.
Exactly. It's about clearing out the clutter in the rule book, maybe making it a bit easier for folks in agriculture to navigate. And it reduces some administrative overhead for the agencies, too. It's that behind-the-scenes work that keeps the government machine running, hopefully, a bit more smoothly.
Okay, now let's pivot. We're going from the farm to the skies, impacting air travel. We're talking about the nuts and bolts of airplane safety, specifically airworthiness directives from the FAA.
These are always important.
Definitely. First, there's a new airworthiness directive, or AD, effective September 18, 2025. This one's specifically for various Airbus models, the A319, A320, and A321 families.
Okay, popular planes.
Very. This AD was prompted because there were occurrences of something called high-pressure bleed valve butterfly seal retention clip rupture. Sounds technical, right?
Very technical, but clearly a safety concern if it's prompting an ADE.
Absolutely. So the FAA is requiring operators to revise their airplane flight manuals and their minimum equipment lists. They also give operators the option to just replace the affected part entirely. That's called a terminating action. It fully resolves the issue for that component.
So fix the paperwork or fix the part?
Basically. Now, the FAA did look at the cost. They estimate about 9 work hours per replacement plus parts comes out to around $300 to $600 per cycle.
Hmm.
But, and this is key for the airlines, the manufacturer, Airbus, might cover some or all of that under warranty.
Ah, oh, that makes a difference.
Big difference. And because of that potential warranty coverage and the overall scope, the FAA determined this is not a significant regulatory action. It means the industry can handle this update without major disruption.
And this really highlights the absolute priority of safety in aviation, doesn't it? It's a direct response to a detected mechanical issue. These AEDs are just critical for keeping the commercial fleet safe.
It's like a car recall, but way higher stakes.
Exactly. Way higher stakes. The FAA acts quickly, decisively, making sure planes meet the highest standards. That's a huge reason why flying is generally so safe. They look at the economics, sure, but safety comes first. And the fact it's not deemed significant cost-wise suggests it's manageable, especially with potential warranty help. It's that constant balancing act, economic reality versus non-negotiable safety.
And it's not just Airbus getting attention today. Bombardier aircraft are also covered in a separate AD. Shows this vigilance is industry-wide.
Keeps everyone on their toes.
This is another new AD, also effective September 18th. This time it's for certain Bombardier model BD-700-1A-10 airplanes.
Okay.
The problem identified here came from a report that found non-compliant clearance between critical components, specifically therapeutic flexible oxygen hoses and electrical harnesses.
Oh, that doesn't sound good. Things too close together.
Exactly. Too close. And lacking proper insulation or protective barriers. A potential hazard, for sure.
Definitely.
So the FAA is requiring operators to do detailed inspections of these oxygen hoses and electrical harnesses, checking for damage, and crucially, checking for enough space between them. If they find any issues, they need to investigate and fix them immediately.
Makes sense.
And similar to the Airbus AD, the FAA certifies the economic impact here isn't considered significant. Again, costs might be covered under warranty.
This really underscores the FAA's proactive approach, doesn't it? Finding a potential issue like this, oxygen lines and electrical systems too close before something bad happens, is just paramount.
Preventive maintenance at its core.
Absolutely. It's about stopping problems before they start. These are the tiny details passengers never see, but they are utterly vital for safety. And seeing two separate ADs for different manufacturers on the same day, it just reinforces the constant vigilance needed across the entire aviation industry. It's a dynamic process, always looking for potential risks to keep flying as safe as possible.
Okay, let's shift from the skies to global trade. The Census Bureau has made some notable amendments to its foreign trade regulations. Now, this sounds like it gets into the weeds of who reports what when goods cross borders. That can get pretty nuanced, right?
Oh, absolutely. These regulations are the foundation for accurate trade statistics and making sure companies comply with the rules. Even seemingly small changes here can have pretty big ripple effects for any business involved in international commerce.
Right. So the Census Bureau is amending its foreign trade regulations, or FTR. These govern how export information gets reported. And importantly, they're doing this based on public comments they received.
Which is always a good sign, shows they're listening to the industry.
Exactly. Let's dig into some of the key areas they tweaked. First, a really critical clarification on who counts as the USPPI, that's the U.S. principal party in interest.
The main U.S. entity in the transaction.
Right. The rule now emphasizes that a USPPI has to be aware if their employer identification number, their EIN, is being used by an authorized agent acting on their behalf.
So no surprises. They need to know who's filing under their name.
Precisely. The Census Bureau stressed the need for continuous communication between the parties. Agents should only report information they got directly from the USPPI. They also clarified a common scenario in logistics. If a customs broker is the importer of record for goods that are then exported without change within 30 days.
Like a quick turnaround shipment.
Exactly. In that case, the customs broker is listed as the USPPI. But after 30 days, that responsibility shifts, usually to the warehouse or storage facility that actually has control of the goods.
Okay, nailing down responsibility, that's important.
Definitely. Next up, the state of origin data element. Some commenters felt this was redundant, since the USPPI's address already includes a state code.
Makes sense. Why report it twice?
Well, the Bureau actually agrees it's duplicative. But they're not removing it just yet. They want to research the impact first, make sure current reporting stays accurate. So, status quo for now on that one.
Interesting. Acknowledging the issue, but pausing on the fix.
Yeah. Now, a bigger change happened with the entry number versus country of origin debate, especially for goods entering foreign trade zones, or FTZs.
Ah, FTZs add complexity.
They do. Initially, the Bureau wanted to collect the specific entry number for goods going into FTZs. The idea was to link it to import data and automate some processes.
Sounds efficient on paper.
On paper, yes. But the industry pushed back hard. They flagged major costs and operational challenges. Things like software limitations, difficulty tracking goods within the zone, lack of IT systems. They worried it would lead to inaccurate data.
Real-world problems hitting a proposed solution.
Exactly. And the Census Bureau listened. They agreed with the commenters about the challenges. So instead of the entry number, they will now collect the country of origin directly for FTZ goods. A much more practical approach, apparently.
That sounds like a significant pivot based on feedback.
It is. They also put stricter limits on disclosing electronic export information, or EEI.
Mm.
The new rules clarify that this sensitive trade data cannot be fully disclosed to a foreign person or government.
Protecting sensitive information.
Right. And they tighten penalties for illegal activities. The rule now explicitly says that account deactivation can be a penalty for anyone who knowingly reports, or otherwise uses the AES automated export system to further any illegal activity. That's on top of potential fines and jail time.
Adding more teeth to the enforcement.
Seems like it. And one final point here, they clarified responsibilities in routed export transactions, where the foreign buyer authorizes the U.S. seller to file the export info. It emphasizes data retention, accuracy, and the security of login credentials.
Okay, this whole package of changes, it's a really big deal for anyone involved in international trade, isn't it?
Absolutely.
It's all about ensuring accuracy and compliance in what is, let's face it, a very complex system. And it really shows the Census Bureau listening to industry feedback. That pivot you mentioned from entry number to country of origin for FTZs, that's a perfect example of an aha moment in regulation.
Right. Sometimes the point idea isn't the best one in practice.
Exactly. It shows that even with the best intentions, a proposed solution can run into real-world operational barriers. The Bureau's willingness to adjust here is a good sign, responsive governance recognizing that a rule needs to be practical to actually work.
Mm.
And those detailed rules on disclosing EEI and securing logins, they really underscore how sensitive trade data is and the government's efforts to protect it. That's particularly relevant today with all the concerns about data security and intense trade scrutiny. Every bit of data matters, both for economic reasons and national security.
Definitely a lot for businesses in that space to digest. Okay, let's shift gears now to proposed rules. These are the government's intentions, things they're planning to do, but they're open for public comment before they become final.
So this is where the public gets a chance to weigh in.
Exactly. And first up, we have some important environmental updates for the EPA. This one concerns Rhode Island.
Okay.
The Environmental Protection Agency is proposing to approve Rhode Island's State Implementation Plan, or SIP, revision. This specific revision removes the requirement for stage I vapor recovery systems at gas stations.
Ah, okay. So let me give a little background here, because this involves some technology shifts. For years, gas stations had two kinds of vapor recovery systems. Stage I captured fumes when the big tanker truck filled the underground tanks.
Right.
And stage II was the system on the pump nozzle itself, capturing fumes when you filled up your car. Both were designed to cut down on volatile organic compounds, VOCs, which cause ozone pollution.
Okay, so what changed?
The game changer was something called onboard refueling vapor recovery, or ORVR. These systems are built directly into cars now. Back in 2012, the EPA figured out that ORVR was in widespread use across the country. Something like over 75% of gas refueling was covered by it.
So the car itself catches the vapors now.
Exactly. And because those ORVR systems in cars are so effective, the stage two systems at the pump became largely redundant. The EPA even started waiving the federal requirement for states to have stage two systems in certain areas.
Got it. So Rhode Island is taking advantage of that flexibility.
Precisely. Their updated plan removes the old stage I requirement and instead incorporates California's newer enhanced standards for vapor recovery. They're basically updating their rules to reflect the current technology.
And this is a great example, isn't it, of how regulations adapt. What was essential yesterday might become less so as technology like ORVR become common.
Right. It's about being smarter with environmental controls.
And for you, the consumer, it might mean simpler pump nozzles eventually, maybe less hassle at the gas station. But you're still getting better air quality overall because the tech is now built into most cars. It also shows that federal rules can set a baseline, but states have flexibility to tailor things based on local tech adoption.
A good example of regulatory evolution.
Definitely. Now, speaking of air quality, there's also some good news coming out of Michigan, specifically for the Detroit area, regarding sulfur dioxide.
SO2. Nasty stuff.
Yeah. The EPA is proposing to officially find that the Detroit, Michigan area is now meeting the 2010 National Air Quality Standard for Sulfur Dioxide, or SO2. They're also proposing to approve Michigan's request to redesignate the area as being in attainment and to approve their plan for maintaining that clean air status.
That's great news. Just to remind folks, SO2, even in short bursts, can really harm your respiratory system, makes breathing difficult, especially for kids with asthma. And high concentrations can damage trees and plants, too. The federal standard is pretty strict, 75 parts per billion.
And the data backs this up.
It seems so. Michigan runs 5 SO2 monitors in the area, and the data consistently shows they're meeting the standard now.
So why the improvement?
The EPA credits permanent and enforceable reductions in emissions. These came from Michigan's own state plan and federal regulations. Specifically, they point to permits for major industrial facilities like U.S. Steel, DTE Energy, Carmi's Lime, and others. These permits include enforceable SO2 emission limits.
Actual limits making a difference.
Seems like it. There's even a specific detail. U.S. Steel finished building a new, taller 170-foot stack by November 2024, which helps disperse emissions better. And Michigan has confirmed these facilities are in full compliance.
So this is a significant public health win for people in the Detroit area.
Absolutely. Cleaner air, especially for vulnerable groups.
And it really highlights how the Clean Air Act works, right? Targeted regulations, industry compliance, actual investments like that new stack. It can lead to real, measurable improvements in the environment.
It's a regulatory success story, potentially.
And practically speaking, this approval means Michigan gets more control back from the feds, ending a federal oversight deadline that was looming.
Good news all around for Detroit's air, it seems.
Seems that way. And still on the topic of SO2, North Carolina is also proposing a rule clarification.
Okay, what's this one about?
The EPA is proposing to incorporate a specific North Carolina rule into their federally approved plan. The rule is called Sulfur Dioxide Emissions from Combustible Sources. The key clarification here is that sources cannot demonstrate compliance with the SO2 emission standard by burning excess supplemental fuel beyond what is necessary for proper operation.
I see where this is going. They can't just burn extra fuel to dilute the exhaust stream and make the concentration look lower.
Exactly. It prevents polluters from essentially gaming the system. Instead of actually reducing their SO2 output, they might try to just dilute the measurement. This rule closes that potential loophole.
That's a very specific but actually very important clarification. It ensures that when a company says it's complying, it's doing so genuinely, not just through some workaround. It protects the integrity of the air quality standards. Subtle, maybe, but powerful.
Definitely reinforces the intent of the regulations. Okay, shifting from air quality to healthcare. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, has published a correcting document for its physician fee schedule for calendar year 2026. Now, these aren't entirely new rules, but corrections to proposals. Still, some of these fixes have real-world implications, right?
Absolutely. This document is basically CMS saying, oops, we made some errors in our previous proposal. Here are the corrections. But even seemingly minor technical fixes in something as vast as the physician fee schedule can significantly impact how healthcare is delivered and paid for.
Right. Let's look at a couple of key corrections and what they mean. First, there's a discussion around CPT code 95800. That's the code for unattended sleep studies, often done at home for sleep apnea. An interested party, likely a device maker or a medical society, has repeatedly flagged this code as potentially misvalued. Their argument is that there's been a fundamental shift in clinical practice.
From what to what?
From older, reusable home sleep apnea testing devices to newer, fully disposable ones. They commissioned a survey with input from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which found that in 2023, a whopping 60% of procedures using this code actually used fully disposable equipment, not the older reusable tech that the current Medicare payment model is based on.
Ah, so the payment doesn't match the current technology being used.
Exactly. The implication is that the current payment, specifically the part covering direct practice expenses, doesn't reflect the actual costs of using these newer disposable devices. This could lead to inaccurate direct practice expenses and potentially create access challenges for Medicare beneficiaries, especially in rural or remote areas where disposable devices are often more practical.
Makes sense. If you can't get paid properly for the device, you might not offer the service.
Right. The nominator suggests updating the reimbursement, maybe replacing the codes for reusable equipment with a new supply code specifically for these disposable devices.
That's a really interesting example of how technology can outpace the payment systems.
It really is. Another correction involves the KX modifier thresholds for outpatient therapy services. You might remember these used to be called therapy caps.
Right, the limits on how much therapy Medicare would cover per year.
Exactly. Those hard caps are gone, but these thresholds remain. They get updated annually based on inflation, specifically the Medicare Economic Index, or MEI. For CY 2026, CMS is proposing to increase the 2025 threshold to $2,410 by about 2.7%.
Yep.
That brings the proposed 2026 threshold to $2,480.
Okay, so a slight increase.
A slight increase.
Yeah.
That's $2,480 for combined physical therapy and speech-language pathology services, and another separate $2,480 threshold for occupational therapy services.
And how does this threshold work in practice?
If a beneficiary's therapy expenses for the year go above that threshold, the provider has to add a specific code, the KX modifier, to any subsequent claims for that patient. By using that modifier, the provider is attesting that the services are medically necessary and properly documented.
And if they don't use the modifier,
the claim gets denied. It's a way to flag higher cost cases for potential review, ensuring services remain appropriate.
Got it. So the sleep study correction, that's particularly fascinating, isn't it? It really highlights how fast technology moves and how reimbursement policies can lag behind, creating real access problems. If providers aren't paid fairly for newer, possibly better, disposable devices, patients might lose out, especially those in underserved areas who benefit most from home testing.
A real-world impact.
Definitely. And those TFX modifier thresholds, they're crucial for managing Medicare spending on therapy. It's that constant balancing act, ensuring patients get the necessary care without enabling overutilization or fraud. The annual adjustment just reflects the economic realities in healthcare. These corrections, even though they're fixing prior proposals, really underscore the immense complexity of federal healthcare policy. Every single word, every number has downstream consequences.
It's a massive, intricate system. Now let's turn our attention to conservation. There's a proposed rule concerning a rather unique reptile, the earless monitor.
Ah, an interesting one. Not native to the U.S., right?
Correct. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is proposing to list the earless monitor lizard as a threatened species under the Endangered Species Act, the ESA. This proposal also includes something called a 4D rule, which basically lays out specific protective regulations tailored for threatened species.
And why threatened? What's putting them at risk?
The FWS concluded the species is likely to become in danger of extinction within the foreseeable future. They identified several key threats. First, major habitat loss and modification. This is primarily driven by slash and burn agriculture, especially for expanding oil palm plantations in places like Indonesia and Malaysia where they live.
Destroying their home.
Exactly. It destroys tree root systems that stabilize stream banks, causing erosion and sediment buildup in streams. This messes up the ecosystem, impacting the worms and crustaceans the monitors feed on. Second, there's overcollection and illegal trade.
The pet trade strikes again?
Sadly, yes. The species is highly sought after for the international pet trade, leading to unsustainable harvesting from the wild. And third, pesticide use. Insecticide use in Indonesia tied to those oil palm plantations has skyrocketed like a 700% increase between 1990 and 2021.
Wow.
These chemicals are found in soil and water and are likely killing off the invertebrates that are the monitor's main food source.
So habitat loss, pet trade, and poisoning their food supply. A tough combination.
A very tough combination. Now, about those protective regulations, the 4D rule. The ESA requires the government to issue regulations needed to conserve threatened species. This proposed rule would generally apply the same prohibitions as for endangered species.
Like the ban on take.
Exactly. Oh. Take means harassing, harming, pursuing, hunting, shooting, wounding, killing, trapping, capturing, or collecting. It also typically includes bans on import, export, and commercial activity. So pretty strict protections are proposed.
Are there any exceptions?
Yes, there are potential exemptions or permits. FWS can issue permits for things like scientific purposes, enhancing propagation or survival, zoological exhibition, educational purposes, or even incidental take under specific circumstances. There's also a very limited exemption for specimens that were already in captivity before the lifting, as long as they weren't held for commercial purposes.
Okay, some flexibility for research and conservation.
Right. And it's worth noting, the Earless Monitor is already listed under CITES, the International Treaty Regulating Trade in Endangered Species. So international trade is already restricted. This U.S. listing under the ESA would add another layer of protection, particularly regarding import into the U.S. and activities within the U.S.
This proposal really highlights the global reach of the Endangered Species Act, doesn't it? Protecting unique creatures, even if they're not found here. It hammers home that actions in one part of the world, like deforestation for palm oil, have ripple effects on global biodiversity.
The connected world.
Absolutely. And that mention of the pet trade, it's just sobering. It reminds us how consumer demand for exotic animals can push species towards extinction. The 4D rule tries to strike that necessary balance, strong protections, but allowing for essential activities like scientific study and conservation breeding. It's where the complex debate around conservation efforts and their impacts really plays out.
A critical effort for a unique species. Okay, now for something quite different and potentially very significant, a development from the White House affecting the nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Today's Federal Register includes an executive order giving us a glimpse into a specific and apparently urgent federal response to local conditions.
Oh, this sounds important. What's the order?
This is Executive Order 14333. It was actually signed on August 11th, 2025, and it's titled Exercising Operational Control Over the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia.
Wow. Operational control. That sounds major.
It does. The president's rationale laid out in the order is quite stark. It declares that special conditions of an emergency nature exist in D.C., specifically due to a precipitous rise in violent crime.
Okay, citing a crime emergency as the trigger.
Exactly. And the order explicitly states that this increase in violent crime poses intolerable risks to the vital federal functions located in D.C.
Linking local crime directly to federal operations.
Precisely. The risks mentioned include hindering the recruitment and retention of essential federal employees, undermining critical government functions which impacts the whole nation, and even eroding confidence in the strength of the United States.
Strong language.
Very strong. The president states that citizens, tourists, and federal workers deserve peace and security, not fear and violence, and that the smooth functioning of government demands an effective law enforcement mechanism capable of halting the precipitous rise in violent crime. It even cites specific instances of government workers to be violently attacked by mobs or fatally shot close to the federal buildings where they work.
So the justification is protecting the federal government's ability to function safely in the Capitol.
That's the core argument. Now, the mechanism. The president's authority for this action comes from Section 748 of the D.C. Home Rule Act, which allows the president to direct the mayor during special emergency conditions. And that authority is being delegated to the Attorney General.
Okay, so the AG is now effectively in charge of how MPD resources are used for this purpose?
That's the direction. The mayor of D.C. is directed to provide such services of the Metropolitan Police Force as the Attorney General may deem necessary and appropriate. The Attorney General will monitor the situation, consult regularly, update the president, and advise if the order needs further action or is no longer necessary.
This is quite an extraordinary use of executive power, leveraging that specific provision in the Home Rule Act. Normally, MPD answers to the DC mayor and council. This order signals a significant federal intervention, essentially a partial takeover, of local policing functions, framed as an emergency response needed to protect federal interests and personnel.
It definitely raises immediate questions, doesn't it, about the balance of power between the federal government and the district's limited self-governance.
Absolutely. It hits right at that core tension in D.C.'s unique status as the federal district, but also a city where people live and work.
For residents, it means federal priorities, as defined by the Attorney General in this context, will directly influence local law enforcement strategies and deployments. That could mean shifts in resources or policing approaches that might differ from what the local government would prioritize.
And for the nation, it sends a very clear message about the perceived state of security in the capital city. That has broader implications, potentially affecting tourism, recruitment, and even international perceptions.
It also brings up those complex questions around civil liberties, doesn't it? And police accountability, community relations. When federal authority steps in this directly, How does that affect the trust between local police and the communities they serve?
That's a critical question. And what are the long-term implications for DC's autonomy if an order like this were to be sustained for a long period or maybe even expanded? It sets a precedent that will undoubtedly be watched very closely.
Indeed. It's a very sensitive area. The justifications laid out protecting federal functions, ensuring safety will certainly be scrutinized intensely. This is definitely one to watch in terms of how it's implemented on the ground and whether any legal challenges emerge.
A major development, no question.
Okay, let's move into the notices section of the Federal Register now. This section is a mix of announcements, public hearing schedules, requests for comments, and various other agency actions. They often signal what's coming next or provide crucial transparency. There's a lot here today, so we'll pick out some key ones.
All right, let's see what's in the notices.
First, from the Department of Agriculture's Natural Resources Conservation Service, or NRCS. There's a notice about the Hermit's Peak and Calf Canyon Burn Scar Project Watershed Plan in New Mexico.
Ah, responding to that massive wildfire.
Exactly. New Mexico's largest wildfire in history. NRCS is preparing a Programmatic Environmental Impact Statement, a PEI, for this project. The goal is to address the aftermath on private lands, things like flooding, sedimentation, erosion, water quality problems caused by the severe burn.
So helping private landowners recover.
Yes, and protect communities. It aims to increase flood resilience, protect affected towns, and restore ecosystem functions, healthy streams, forests, soils, plants, animals. They're working alongside the Forest Service, which handles the national forest lands involved. The scope is huge, about 500 square miles across 7 counties.
A massive undertaking.
It really is. They've opened a 45-day public scoping period, running until September 29th, inviting comments on significant issues and alternatives. They'll evaluate 4 alternatives, including doing nothing. And importantly, they have to consult under the National Historic Preservation Act and the Clean Water Act. Mm-hmm. And crucially, NRCS will consult with Native American tribes and pueblos on a government-to-government basis.
This notice really shows the scale of effort needed to recover from catastrophic wildfires. It highlights the long-term consequences and the multifaceted approach required addressing environmental damage, protecting communities, infrastructure,
and cultural resources, too.
Exactly. That specific mention of restoring acequias, the traditional irrigation systems, is fascinating. It emphasizes restoring not just ecological health, but also preserving traditional agricultural practices and cultural heritage that are vital to that region. It's a great example of interagency collaboration and the essential role of public and tribal input in major environmental and land management decisions.
A long road to recovery there. Okay, the USDA also has a couple of notices from its Rural Utility Service, or RUS. These deal with loans and consolidations for rural electric and telephone providers.
The backbone of rural infrastructure.
Pretty much. These are actually just notices requesting comments on extending existing information collections. One is about collecting audited financial statements from borrowers to assess creditworthiness for loan prepayments. The other deals with information needed when electric borrowers merge or consolidate, which is happening more due to industry changes.
So, seem like routine administrative stuff, but important nonetheless.
Exactly. While they might seem like niche details, they're crucial for the stability and ongoing development of essential electric and phone services in rural America. Those RUS loans are fundamental.
And the merger notice shows how regulators have to adapt, right? As the utility industry restructures, the government needs ways to oversee those changes to protect the public interest and ensure people in rural areas still get reliable service.
Good point. Okay, from rural utilities to the broader economy. The Census Bureau has another notice today. This one impacting how we understand wholesale trade.
What's this one?
The Census Bureau is proposing to extend, without any changes, its monthly wholesale trade survey. Comments are due by October 14th. This survey collects vital economic data from U.S. merchant wholesale firms.
Ah, the monthly wholesale trade survey. It's one of those unsung heroes of economic indicators.
How so?
Well, the data from this survey gives us one of the earliest snapshots of what's happening in the wholesale sector. That's a key part of the supply chain, right? So it helps us understand the health of that sector, which feeds into overall economic activity, inventory levels, potential inflation pressures. It's an important piece of the economic puzzle.
So even though it's just an extension notice, the survey itself is pretty significant.
Exactly. And the fact that it's an extension without change suggests they have a stable, consistent method for collecting this data, which is valuable for tracking trends over time.
Got it. Okay, let's look at international trade again. Specifically, this notice concerns hot-rolled steel flat products from the Republic of Korea.
Okay, trade remedies in action.
Seems like it. This notice announces the final results of a countervailing duty administrative review. The purpose of these reviews, as we discussed earlier, is to figure out if foreign governments are giving subsidies to their producers that unfairly lower prices and hurt U.S. industries.
So did they find subsidies in this case? The notice usually details the findings.
The notice confirms the final results are published, implying determinations were made, but the summary here focuses on the process itself. The core point is ensuring that level playing field for U.S. steel producers.
Right. If a foreign government subsidizes its steel industry, it can distort market prices, making it incredibly hard for American companies to compete fairly based on efficiency and quality alone. Countervailing duties are the tool designed to offset those subsidies, protecting U.S. jobs and industries. These reviews are just a constant feature of managing global trade relations and economic competition.
A necessary part of the trade landscape. Okay, moving from industrial policy to ocean life. We have a notice from NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, specifically the National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS.
What are they noticing?
NMFS has received a request from its own Southwest Fisheries Science Center, the SWFSSC. They're asking for authorization to take. And remember, under the Marine Mammal Protection Act, take can mean harass, injure, or even kill incidentally small numbers of marine mammals over the next 5 years. This would happen during their fisheries research activities.
Ah, the research versus conservation balance.
Exactly. This would actually be the third such authorization for the SWFSC. The notice points out that they have complied with their previous authorizations, stayed within the permitted take limits, and their monitoring reports are publicly available.
That transparency is key. This really exemplifies that delicate balance, doesn't it? You need to conduct essential scientific research that research-informed sustainable fisheries management, helps us understand ocean ecosystems, but you also have to protect marine mammals under the MMPA.
A constant tension.
It is, and the fact that their past compliance and monitoring reports are public, that underscores the transparency built into this process. It allows for public scrutiny and holds the agency accountable for minimizing impacts while still gathering vital data.
Makes sense. And another notice from NOAA, this one related to public perception.
Okay.
NOAA is requesting a revision and extension for an approved information collection. It's about using quick response surveys to build a public perception and response database. They estimate surveying over 33,000 respondents, taking about 10 minutes each.
So they want to know what the public thinks and how they react to things.
Seems like it. NOAA's mission is broad weather forecasting, coastal management, fisheries, climate. Understanding public perception and how people respond to, say, weather warnings or coastal hazard information is crucial for effective communication.
Especially during emergencies.
Exactly. Or even just for tailoring their services to better meet what the public actually needs or understands. This is really about using data to improve public service delivery.
Data-driven public service. Makes sense.
Okay, next. Supporting employment for people with disabilities. There's a direct action on that front in today's register.
What is it?
This notice comes from the Committee for Purchase. From people who are blind or severely disabled, they are officially adding a specific product, copy paper, premium multi-purpose, 8.5 mm by 11, 2,500 sheet convenience pack, 30% recycled, to the procurement list.
And what does that mean, being on the procurement list?
It means that small entities associated with people who are blind or severely disabled are now authorized, in fact, prioritized, to supply this specific type of copy paper to the federal government.
Ah, so it's a very direct way the government supports employment for people with disabilities.
Extremely direct. It's a statutory requirement under the Javits-Wagner-O'Day Act. Certain products and services must be procured from these nonprofit agencies that employ people with significant disabilities.
So it's not just a suggestion, it's mandated. It might seem like a small thing, copy paper, but the ripple effect is significant, right? It creates real economic opportunities, fosters independence, provides meaningful work for a population that often faces high unemployment rates.
Exactly. A tangible social impact through procurement policy.
Very interesting.
Okay, from procurement back to transparency. The Department of Energy, DOE, is reaching out about old Freedom of Information Act, or FOIA, requests.
Cleaning house on FOIA requests.
Kind of. DOE headquarters is conducting what they call a still interested inquiry. They're looking at FOIA requests that were filed before fiscal year 2025,
mm-hmm.
So before October 1st, 2024. The goal is to increase efficiency and reduce their backlog.
So they're asking people, hey, do you still actually want the information you asked for way back when?
Pretty much. It allows DOE to determine if requesters are still interested in these older requests. If not, they can administratively close them. If they are, presumably it helps prioritize them. The idea is to process active requests more efficiently. Responses are due by September 15th, 2025.
This makes a lot of sense. The Freedom of Information Act is absolutely a cornerstone of government transparency, letting citizens see what the government is up to. But FOIA backlogs are a huge, persistent challenge across almost all federal agencies.
They get swamped with requests.
Totally. So this kind of proactive approach, checking if old requests are still needed, helps clear out the inactive ones. That frees up limited resources for the current relevant inquiries, ultimately making the FOIA process work better for everyone trying to access information. It's a practical step to manage the sheer volume.
A necessary bit of administrative work for transparency. Okay, let's turn to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC. They regulate interstate electricity and natural gas. They have a few key notices today.
Always busy at FERC.
Seems so. First, there's a combined notice of filings, #1. This is basically a compilation of various electric corporate filings that FERC received recently. Things related mostly to mergers, acquisitions, and rate adjustments in the power sector.
So the day-to-day business of energy market regulation.
It's like it. Examples include joint applications for authorization for power plants, tariff amendments from grid operators like PJM Interconnection, and applications for market-based rates from energy companies.
Right. FERC oversees the wholesale electricity markets and interstate pipelines. These filings are how they ensure those markets are operating fairly, efficiently, and reliably. You see mentions of different grid operators like PJM or Midcontinent ISO. It just highlights the complexity and constant evolution of the U.S. power grid and its regulation.
Okay, second notice from FERC today. This one involves Erie Boulevard Hydropower.
It's hydropower.
FERC is notifying the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, the DEC, about a request Erie Boulevard Hydropower made. They're seeking a water quality certification under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act.
Ah, the state water quality certification. That's a crucial step for any project affecting waterways, especially hydro projects.
Why is it so important?
Well, Section 401 gives states the authority to review federal permits or licenses, like one from FERC, for a hydro project, to ensure the project complies with state water quality standards, as well as other state regulations and the Clean Water Act itself. It's a key part of the environmental review, protecting water quality, aquatic life, and downstream uses. FERC can't issue its license without this state certification or a waiver.
So it's a state-level check within the federal process.
Exactly. Ensures local water quality concerns are addressed.
Got it. And a third notice from FERC. This involves Northern Natural Gas Company.
Project.
Yes.
Northern Natural Gas has applied to construct and operate new natural gas facilities. FERC is giving notice about the application and opening it up for public comment and intervention.
Well, it's the project.
It involves about 1.9 miles of new 20-inch diameter pipeline in Pottawatomie County, Iowa, and modifications to a compressor station in Sarpy County, Nebraska. It's part of what they call the Siouxland Pipeline Loop Project.
And
the filing says it's to provide additional natural gas to existing delivery points in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. So increasing capacity to that area.
Okay. And the public can weigh in.
Yes. Comments are due by October 10th, 2025. And importantly, any person, landowners, ratepayers, residents, environmental groups can file a motion to intervene. Becoming an intervener makes you a formal party to the proceeding.
Which gives you more rights in the process.
Exactly. It grants the right to request rehearing of commission orders and even challenge them in federal court later on.
So this notice really reflects that ongoing expansion of natural gas infrastructure to meet regional energy demands, right? It's always that balancing act, ensuring energy supply versus addressing the local environmental impacts and community concerns.
And the emphasis on public comment and the right to intervene really highlights the importance of giving local communities a voice in these big energy projects that directly affect their land, their environment, maybe even their property values. It's where the abstract need for energy meets very concrete local concerns.
Absolutely. That intervention process is critical for landowner rights.
Okay, moving back to the EPA, they have a couple of final orders on petitions today involving Clean Air Act permits for industrial facilities.
Ah, the outcomes of those challenges we talked about earlier.
Exactly. Two separate notices here detailing final orders on petitions where groups asked EPA to object to state-issued Clean Air Act operating permits.
What were the decisions?
For the Valero Houston Refinery Tank Farm, the EPA granted in part and denied in part a petition filed by Texas Environmental Justice Groups and the Sierra Club. For Kinder Morgan Altamont, LLC, the EPA granted a petition filed by the Center for Biological Diversity.
Okay, so mixed results for Valero, full grant for Kinder Morgan. What does that tell us?
Well, it shows the EPA performing that crucial oversight role on state permits. Environmental groups use this petition process to flag permits they think are too weak or violate federal law.
Acting as watchdogs.
Right. And the granted in part, denied in part for Valero suggests a nuanced decision. EPA agreed with some of the petitioner's points, but not others. The full grant for Kinder Morgan indicates EPA found more significant issues with that permit, agreeing more strongly with the petitioner's concerns. This whole process adds an important layer of accountability to industrial pollution control.
Insurance permits meet federal standards, even as issued by the state.
Exactly. Okay, from air quality to airwaves. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, has a notice about TV broadcasting standards.
What about TV?
The FCC is proposing to extend an information collection related to something called the ATSC PSAP standard A65C. That mouthful refers to the standard governing the data transmitted alongside a digital TV broadcast signal.
Ah, the data that tells your TV what's on.
Precisely. It provides viewers with information about the station and the programs. Things like the electronic program guide, what they call event information tables, or EITs, plus information on how to find closed captions, details about multiple program streams if the station offers them, and VCHIP rating information. The FCC says it enhances the consumer's viewing experience.
So this is basically the digital plumbing behind your TV screen guide. Without these standards, your smart TV wouldn't know what program is currently playing, couldn't display the guide for upcoming shows, or easily let you access features like captions.
Makes the digital TV experience work smoothly.
Exactly. It ensures a consistent and informative viewing experience across different TVs and devices in the digital age. And this notice mentions it's an upgrade from the previous A65B standard, requiring more detailed programming info. That reflects the demands of modern viewing habits and smarter TVs.
Keeping the standards up to date with the tech. Okay, let's turn to some crucial social services now. Few notices from the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS.
All right, what's HHS up to?
First, from the Administration for Children and Families, ACF, specifically the Office on Trafficking in Persons, or OT, they're requesting an extension and some revisions to their approved information collection for the Trafficking Victim Assistance Program, or TVAP, data.
Collecting data on services for trafficking victims.
Yes. This data is vital, they say, for measuring the performance of grant projects, helping victims, providing technical assistance to those grantees, assessing program outcomes overall, informing evaluations, responding to inquiries from Congress, and shaping policy and program development so it's actually tailored to the needs of trafficking survivors.
So it's about making sure the help being offered is effective and reaching the right people.
Exactly. The data collected includes participant demographics, age, sex, type of trafficking experience, where services were provided, as well as the specific services provided. They also collect aggregate data on outreach efforts and how the grant money was spent. The revisions mentioned are minor updates to align with their internal data system.
This data collection, while it might sound administrative, is absolutely essential. It's how you ensure that programs designed to help incredibly vulnerable people trafficking survivors are actually effective and responsive. It's about accountability for taxpayer dollars and driving continuous improvement in services.
Using data to make programs better.
Precisely. The information gathered directly informs policy decisions, helping the government understand the scope of the problem and how best to allocate resources to support survivors effectively. It's critical work.
Agreed. Next notice, also from ACF, this time from the Office of Family Assistance. This concerns the caseload reduction documentation process.
Ah, welfare caseloads and work requirements. This sounds potentially significant.
It is. ACF is requesting a 3-year extension, but with substantive changes, for the form states use to report their welfare caseloads, form ACF 202.
Mm-hmm.
This report is crucial because it's used to calculate a state's caseload reduction credit.
And that credit matters because
it reduces the state's required work participation rate under the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Program, TANF. Basically, if a state demonstrates it has reduced its welfare caseload significantly compared to a baseline year, it gets a credit, meaning fewer recipients have to meet strict federal work requirements.
Okay, so reducing the caseload lowers the bar for work participation roles. What's the big change?
The big change comes directly from the Fiscal Responsibility Act of 2023, the FRA. That law significantly recalibrated this credit by changing the base year used for comparison. The old base year was fiscal year 2005. The FRA changed it to fiscal year 2015.
Wow, moving the baseline forward a whole decade. That's huge.
It is. So the revisions to the form and instructions are primarily about reflecting the shift, striking out 2005 and inserting 2015. There are also minor updates to reporting due dates and instructions.
Okay, this is a major policy shift with potentially big consequences for states. Changing the base year from 2005 to 2015. Think about it. States that achieve significant caseload reductions between 2005 and 2015 might now find it much harder to get that credit because their comparison point is now a much lower 2015 caseload.
So their past success doesn't count as much towards the credit anymore.
Exactly. It could make it harder for them to meet their required work participation rates, which could potentially impact their federal TANF funding or force them to spend more state resources to increase participation or document exemptions. It definitely signals a shift in how states are measured and held accountable under TANF.
A significant change embedded in a form update notice. Okay, one more from ACF, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, or ORR. This is about information collection for the Refugee Resettlement Program, particularly forms related to unaccompanied alien children, or UACs.
Okay, dealing with the placement and care of unaccompanied minors. What's changing here?
Several key revisions are proposed. First, updating terminology consistently across forms using unaccompanied alien child, or UAC, instead of older terms, and sponsor specialist, instead of case manager. More substantively, changes are proposed to specific forms used when placing a UAC with a potential sponsor.
Like the background check forms.
Yes. The Authorization for Release of Information form, SAP2, collects written consent for background checks with law enforcement and child welfare agencies. It's used by ORR to help determine if placing a UAC with a potential sponsor is safe. New requirements are added here for who needs to consent potential sponsors and other adult household members.
Makes sense checking everyone in the home.
Right. The Family Reunification Application, SAP3, which potential sponsors fill out, is also changing. Some instructional sections are being moved to a separate document. The email address field is updated. And importantly, a new attestation section is being added.
An attestation, meaning they have to swear the information is true.
Essentially, yes. Respondents have to acknowledge the penalties for knowingly making false statements under federal law, 18 U.S.C. 1001. New columns are also added to collect contact info for all household members, as required by a recent law. And interestingly, the estimated number of respondents for one form, the Letter of Designation for Care of a Child, has significantly decreased.
These updates seem focused on enhancing safety and accountability in the sponsor placement process for UACs.
That appears to be the goal.
The emphasis on thorough background checks covering all adults in the home, ensuring ORR has the info needed for safety determinations, and adding that legal attestation about providing truthful information, it all points towards tightening procedures. This likely reflects the ongoing policy focus and public concern around the safety and well-being of these incredibly vulnerable children arriving alone. It's adapting the system to provide better safeguards.
Okay, now shifting within HHS to the Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA, there's a notice of supplemental award for the Infant Toddler Court Program State Awards.
Infant Toddler Courts. These are specialized courts focusing on very young children in the child welfare system, right?
Exactly. HRSA is providing additional funds to 12 current state-level Infant Toddler Court Program grantees to continue and expand their work in fiscal year 2025. The goal is to build state and local capacity and implement this specialized court approach, which aims to improve outcomes for maltreated infants and toddlers by speeding up permanency decisions and focusing on healthy development.
So more funding for an existing program. Is there anything else changing?
Yes, a significant administrative change. HRSA is transitioning health centers funded under this program, and likely others, from three-year performance periods to four-year performance periods. This will happen either through a one-year extension with funds or a new four-year period after a successful grant competition.
Extending the grant cycle from 3 years to four?
Why? The rationale given is to reduce administrative burden for the health centers. Longer grant cycles mean less frequent, time-consuming application processes. It's also meant to increase HRSA's own operational flexibility and accountability, and importantly, ensure continuity of access to comprehensive primary care for health center patients. It's about stability and predictability.
That makes sense. Reducing paperwork lets centers focus more on patient care.
Right. But to get the extra funds and the extension, grantees still have to submit several forms detailing their budgets, income sources, organizational capacity, staffing, operations, finances, and patient capacity. So oversight remains.
So the infant toddler court program itself is getting a boost, recognizing its importance for vulnerable young children. And the administrative shift to a four-year cycle is a practical change. Reducing the frequency of those massive grant application processes can genuinely allow health centers to focus more on providing services and less on paperwork, a common frustration in the grant-funded world.
But the detailed financial reporting requirements remain.
Absolutely. SF-424A, budget narrative, income analysis. Those ensure robust oversight of how federal dollars are spent, covering everything from staff and equipment down to indirect costs. It's a balance between reducing burden and maintaining accountability.
Okay, from healthcare services to cutting-edge research. The National Institutes of Health, NIH, has a series of meeting notices today.
Ah, the grant review panels.
Exactly. Several notices for virtual meetings of the Center for Scientific Review Special Emphasis panels happening in September and November 2025. Their purpose is straightforward. These panels review and evaluate grant applications for various NIH programs.
Which programs are covered here?
Examples mentioned include complementary and integrative health interventions and outcomes, the Maximizing Investigators Research Award, MARA, and small business, disease management, risk prevention, and health behavior change, a real range.
These meetings, although they happen behind closed doors, are truly the engines driving medical and scientific progress, aren't they? This is where expert scientists decide which research projects get funded with taxpayer money.
Shaping the future of health discovery.
Absolutely. From understanding chronic diseases to developing new therapies, exploring alternative health approaches, supporting small business innovation, the decisions made in these panels have enormous long-term impact. And the review process itself is incredibly rigorous and competitive, designed to ensure that public funds are invested in the most promising and potentially impactful research.
A critical, if often unseen, part of scientific advancement. Okay, now a notice that impacts pretty much anyone who flies. The TSA, Transportation Security Administration, is looking for feedback on passenger satisfaction.
How satisfied are passengers with airport security? Interesting question.
Well, TSA has forwarded a revision to its Aviation Security Customer Satisfaction Performance Measurement Passenger Survey to the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, for review and approval. The survey basically involves asking travelers about their satisfaction with the security screening process.
Yeah.
The stated goal is to use this feedback to more efficiently manage TSA's security screening performance at airports.
This shows that continued focus from TSA on the passenger experience, not just security effectiveness, right? Which is important. In that high volume, often high stress environment of an airport checkpoint, making the process efficient and maybe less unpleasant matters to people.
Definitely. No one enjoys the security line.
Right. So, using surveys for performance measurement indicates a commitment to using data to improve operations. They're trying to find ways to make the process smoother, maybe faster, while obviously maintaining those critical safety standards. It's about finding that balance between security and customer service.
Trying to make a necessary process less painful. Okay, turning now to land management. The Bureau of Land Management, BLM, has a public meeting notice for the San Rafael Swell Recreation Area in Utah.
Beautiful part of the country. What's happening there?
BLM announced a public field tour on October 1st, 2025, followed by a public meeting on October 2nd for the San Rafael Swell Recreation Area Advisory Council. This council is relatively new, established by that big public lands bill, the Dingell Act.
Right. These advisory councils bring local stakeholders into the management process.
Exactly. This one has 7 members representing diverse interests, local government, recreation groups, grazing permit holders, conservation organizations, historical use advocates, and tribal nations. They advise the Secretary of the Interior, through the BLM, on planning and managing this specific recreation area.
So what's on the agenda for this meeting?
Updates from the local BLM district manager, a presentation on broader resource management plan amendments happening in the region, an overview of the NIPA public comment process, and, importantly, a dedicated public comment period during the meeting.
And the public can attend.
Yes. The public is invited to both the field tour, though they need to register in advance and provide their own transportation and meals, and the meeting itself. Written comments are also welcome.
This is really a classic example of collaborative public land management, isn't it? Bringing together all those diverse stakeholders who often have competing interests to advise the agency on how to balance recreation, conservation, traditional uses like grazing, cultural resource protection, all within a significant natural area.
Trying to find common ground.
And that field tour aspect is particularly good. It offers a direct, hands-on way for the council members and the public to actually see the land they're discussing. That can lead to much more grounded and informed decisions compared to just looking at maps in a meeting room.
Seeing it makes a difference.
Absolutely. The San Rafael Swell is an iconic landscape, and these kinds of collaborative planning efforts are crucial for its long-term health and sustainable public access. It's about ensuring it remains a valuable resource for everyone, for generations to come.
Important work. Now, the National Park Service has multiple notices today, all related to a very significant law, the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, or NAGPRA.
Yes. NAGPRA is incredibly important for Indigenous communities. It deals with the return of ancestors and cultural items.
Exactly. We have four separate notices today of inventory completion under NAGPRA. These notices come from institutions across the country. As you said, NAGPRA requires federal agencies and institutions like museums that receive federal funds to inventory Native American human remains and cultural items in their collections and work towards returning them, repatriating them to the appropriate lineal descendants, culturally affiliated Indian tribes, or Native Hawaiian organizations.
So these notices detail what items have been inventoried and who they're affiliated with.
Precisely. For example, one notice is from Missouri State Parks. They've identified three unassociated funerary objects, items believed to be from death rites, but not found with specific human remains. They've determined these are culturally affiliated with a large group of 20 tribes, namely Chippewa, Ottawa, and Potawatomi bands from the Great Lakes region and Oklahoma. Repatriation to these tribes could happen as soon as September 15th.
Okay, a clear affiliation found there.
Yes. But contrast that with a notice from San Jose State University in California. They completed an inventory of human remains representing 132 individuals and 21 associated funerary objects found with them. However, in this case, they state that no lineal descendant or culturally affiliated Indian tribe or Native Hawaiian organization has been identified for these specific remains and objects through their research so far. Repatriation could still occur if a claimant comes forward.
That highlights one of the real challenges with AGPRA, right? Sometimes the historical connections are difficult or impossible to definitively establish after so much time and displacement.
It seems so. Then we have Sonoma State University, also in California, which completed an inventory of associated funerary objects and has determined cultural affiliation. And finally, a notice from the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation's Division of Archaeology. They identified human remains of 80 individuals and 16 associated funerary objects. Here, a clear cultural connection was determined with the Cherokee Nation, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, the Muscogee Creek Nation, and the United Kituwa Band of Cherokee Indians in Oklahoma.
So repatriation likely for those as well.
Yes. And the Tennessee notice provides some really specific and frankly sometimes unsettling details about how these remains and objects came into the state's possession over the years. Some were looted from a rock shelter. Others transferred from forensic centers after being unidentified or collected during archaeological digs in the early 20th century. Repatriation for all these potentially affiliated items could happen after September 15th.
NEPRA is such landmark legislation. It directly addresses centuries of historical injustice regarding the collection, study, and display of Native American ancestors and cultural heritage. These notices, they represent the tangible results of years, sometimes decades, of painstaking work by tribes, museums, universities, and federal agencies to comply with the law and do the right thing.
It's a long and ongoing process.
It truly is. Repatriation allows for the respectful reburial of ancestors according to tribal traditions and the return of sacred objects needed for ceremony and cultural continuity. It's profoundly important for healing, cultural revitalization, and spiritual well-being within Indigenous communities. But as the San Jose State example shows, the process isn't always straightforward. Establishing affiliation can be incredibly complex due to historical trauma, forced removals, and inadequate record keeping from the past. But the effort itself is crucial.
A vital piece of legislation. Okay, back to trade. The International Trade Commission, the ITC, is stepping in to protect intellectual property, this time related to exercise equipment.
Okay, what kind of equipment and what's the issue?
The ITC has issued both a general exclusion order, or GEO, and a limited exclusion order, or LEO. These orders prohibit the importation into the U.S. of certain exercise equipment and subassemblies that have been found to infringe on U.S. patents held by an American company, Balanced Body Inc., which filed the original complaint. This action officially terminates the ITC's investigation.
So, exclusion orders block infringing products at the border. What's the difference between the GEO and the LAO here?
The general exclusion order is broad. It prohibits any importation of products found to infringe specific claims of two balanced body patents, one utility patent, 511, and one design patent, D208. This applies to imports from any source, regardless of whether the importer was specifically named in the investigation.
That's a powerful remedy. Covers everyone.
It is. The limited exclusion order is narrower. It prohibits products that infringe other specific claims of the 511 patent or another design patent, D205, but only if those products are imported by or on behalf of certain companies that were named as respondents in the case but basically didn't show up or participate the defaulting respondents.
Okay, so the AEO targets specific non-responsive companies, while the GEO is a wider net for certain infringements.
Exactly. The ITC also imposed a 100% bond on the value of any covered products imported during the 60-day presidential review period, just in case the president were to disapprove the orders, which is rare.
This is a really strong tool the ITC has to protect American companies and their innovation from unfair competition caused by patent infringement abroad. Balanced Body, the U.S. company, alleged these violations the ITC investigated and found in their favor, issuing these strong remedies.
Protecting intellectual property.
Right. And that distinction between the GEO and LAO is crucial. Issuing a GEO often signals the ITC believes there's a widespread pattern of infringement or it's hard to identify all the sources, so they need a broad order. The AEO targets the specific bad actors they could identify who didn't cooperate. Using both shows a tailored approach to try and stop IP theft effectively at the border.
Makes sense. And staying with the ITC and trade, they've also made a preliminary determination regarding oleoresin paprika from India.
Oleoresin paprika. That's a concentrated paprika extract used for coloring and flavoring food, right? What's the issue?
The ITC has made a preliminary determination, so not final yet, that there is a reasonable indication that an industry in the United States is materially injured by imports of this oleoresin paprika from India.
Injured how?
The concern alleged is that these imports are being sold in the United States at less than fair value, which is dumping, and that they are being subsidized by the government of India, which triggers countervailing duties.
So a double whammy, potentially anti-dumping and countervailing duty investigations happening simultaneously?
Exactly. This preliminary finding means the investigations will continue. If the Department of Commerce and the ITC ultimately confirm these allegations in their final determinations, then anti-dumping and countervailing duties could be imposed on these imports from India.
This is a significant first step for the U.S. producers of oleoresin paprika, who likely filed the petition. If the final rulings agree with this preliminary finding, it means the U.S. government believes these imports are unfairly priced, harming the domestic industry.
Providing relief for U.S. companies.
Yes. It's another example of how the U.S. uses its trade remedy laws to respond to what it perceives as unfair trade practices, like dumping or subsidies, aiming to ensure American businesses can compete fairly in their own market.
Okay, let's shift from international trade disputes to something closer to home. Postage rates. The Postal Regulatory Commission, or PRC, has a notice about express mail.
What's changing with express mail?
The U.S. Postal Service has filed notice with the PRC, its regulator, about its intention to change rates for something called Inbound Express Mail Service, EMS2. These changes would be effective January 1st, 2026. The key phrase here is that these are rates not of general applicability.
Meaning not the price of a regular stamp or package for everyday consumers?
Exactly. Not of general applicability usually means these rates apply to specific, often negotiated or contract-based services, particularly for international mail coming into the U.S., in this case express mail. It might involve agreements with foreign postal operators.
So it's more on the business or international agreement side of things.
Correct. The PRC's role here is to oversee these kinds of changes, even for specialized services, to ensure they comply with postal law and regulations, are justified, and don't cause undue discrimination among users of the service. It's part of the regulatory oversight of the Postal Service's vast operations.
Got it. Keeping an eye on the specialized stuff, too.
Okay, now let's dive into the financial markets, starting with the Options Clearing Corporation, or OCC.
OCC, the central clearinghouse for U.S.-listed options. Critically important infrastructure.
Indeed. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, has approved a proposed rule change submitted by OCC. The change involves revisions to OCC's stress testing framework. The overall goal is to enhance how OCC assures the safeguarding of securities and funds that are in its custody or control.
Stress testing is huge for clearinghouses. They need to know they can withstand market shocks. What's the specific change?
A key revision explicitly allows certain senior management positions, the Chief Financial Risk Officer, CEO, COO, or Chief Risk Officer, to approve late intraday margin calls.
Late intraday margin calls, meaning demanding more collateral from clearing members outside of the normal end of day or scheduled intraday cycles.
Exactly. It gives OCC more flexibility to demand additional collateral quickly if market conditions warrant it, even if it's late in the trading day.
That makes sense from a risk management perspective. OCC sits in the middle of every options trade. They have to manage the risk that one of their clearing members might default, especially during periods of high volatility. Robust stress testing helps them anticipate potential losses, and the ability to make timely, even late margin calls ensures they have enough collateral on hand to cover potential defaults.
Protecting the system.
Precisely. Allowing senior management to approve these late calls provides that crucial flexibility to react swiftly in fast-moving, potentially risky market situations. It's a technical but important enhancement to financial stability.
Okay, and still in the world of options trading, NASDAQ PHLX, one of the options exchanges, is making some adjustments related to Bitcoin ETFs.
Ah, the intersection of crypto and traditional finance continues to evolve. What's NASDAQ PHLX doing?
They're proposing to amend their rules regarding options trading for several specific Bitcoin exchange-traded funds, or ETFs. The notice lists the iShares Bitcoin Trust ETF, IBIT, the Grayscale Bitcoin Mini Trust ETF, BTC, the Bitwise Bitcoin ETF, BITB, and the Grayscale Bitcoin Trust ETF, GBTC.
So tweaking the rules for options trading on these specific popular Bitcoin ETFs, what kind of rules?
The notice mentions amending rules related to position limits, how many contracts one entity can hold, and rules for FLX options, options with flexible, customizable terms, as they apply to these specific Bitcoin ETFs.
This is just another clear sign of how crypto-related financial products are becoming more integrated into the traditional financial markets, isn't it? Having regulated, exchange-listed options on Bitcoin ETFs gives investors more ways to gain exposure to Bitcoin's price movements, or, importantly, to hedge their existing positions.
Adding more tools for investors.
Right. And for the exchanges like NASDAQ PHLX, it means they constantly have to adapt their rule books. They need to set appropriate position limits, margin requirements, and other trading parameters to accommodate these new and often more volatile asset classes like Bitcoin ETFs, ensuring market integrity and protecting investors while still allowing for innovation.
A continuous adaptation process for the exchanges.
Definitely.
And still more on options trading. The BOXX exchange, another options market, is also updating its rules.
What's BOX changing?
BOX Exchange LLC has filed a proposed rule change that takes effect immediately. It updates and clarifies the obligations for market makers and preferred market makers on their platform.
Market makers are crucial for liquidity. What are the changes to their obligations?
A couple of key things. The rule now explicitly excludes quarterly auction series from the continuous quoting obligations for both types of market makers. These are longer-term options that expire quarterly. It also codifies that intraday add-on series, option series added during the trading day, are excluded from quoting obligations on the day they are added.
So slightly reducing the quoting requirements in specific situations. Anything else?
Yes. They're also removing an apparently outdated rule, Rule 8040, that required market makers to refrain from purchasing options more than 25 cents below parity, except in unusual market conditions.
We remove that.
The rationale BOX provides is that these changes aim to reduce compliance burdens and confusion, especially for firms that are market makers on multiple exchanges. It aligns BOX's rules more closely with other options exchanges. They argue the outdated parity rule is not necessary to maintain fair and orderly markets anymore, and other incentives, like payment for order flow or pricing structures that reward tighter spreads, are now more effective at ensuring good pricing.
Okay, so these are technical adjustments, but important for market efficiency. Market makers provide the bids and offers, the liquidity, that allows everyone else to trade smoothly. Simplifying their obligations, removing outdated rules, and aligning requirements across different exchanges can make it easier and potentially cheaper for them to operate.
Which could lead to better liquidity overall.
Potentially, yes. Better spreads, easier execution for investors. It also shows regulators and exchanges constantly fine-tuning the rules to reflect how trading actually works today, getting rid of regulations that might be burdensome without providing significant benefit anymore. Regulatory modernization in action.
Makes sense. And speaking of exchange mechanics, EDGX Exchange, another stock exchange, has a notice about its fees.
Ah, the fee schedules.
Yeah.
Always changing.
Seems like it. EDGX Exchange, Inc., has amended its fee schedule. Specifically, they've modified the criteria for one of their AdRemove volume tiers, Tier 8, and slightly decreased the rebate associated with this tier for adding liquidity in stocks priced at or above $1.
So tweaking the incentives for high-volume traders. Why?
The rationale given is straightforward. Business and competitive reasons, and to reflect recent higher trading volumes.
Right. Exchange fees are a huge part of the competitive landscape. How much it costs to trade or how much you get paid via rebates for providing liquidity directly impacts the profitability and strategies of trading firms. These seemingly small tweaks to fee tiers can influence where firms decide to send their orders.
Driving volume to their exchange.
Exactly. It highlights that dynamic competition between exchanges. They're constantly adjusting their pricing, their fee structures to attract order flow and liquidity in the battle for market share.
A constant calibration. Okay, next, a notice from the Surface Transportation Board, the STB, which regulates railroads. This concerns rail operations in Louisiana.
What's happening down in Louisiana?
Port Rail, Inc., which is a Class 3 railroad, meaning a smaller, short line or regional railroad, has filed for an exemption. They want to lease and operate two segments of track, totaling about 13.6 miles in Lake Charles, Louisiana.
Okay. Have they been using the track already?
Yes. The notice says Port Rail has leased these tracks since 2016, but mainly for rail car storage and some limited, unregulated switching operations. The change is that, with this exemption, they intend to begin common carrier operations on or after September 18th, 2025.
Ah, becoming a common carrier. That's a significant shift.
What does that mean exactly?
Becoming a common carrier means they are now obligated under federal law to provide rail service to any shipper who reasonably requests it at reasonable rates and without undue discrimination. They become part of the national rail network in a more formal, regulated way. It also means they fall under more of the STB's oversight.
So it's moving from just storing cars to actually hauling freight for customers?
Essentially, yes. This reflects that ongoing evolution in the rail industry, often driven by deregulation that started decades ago, allowing smaller carriers like Port Rail to take on these common carrier roles, sometimes on trackage spun off by larger railroads. For the Lake Charles area, which is a big industrial and port region, this could impact local freight options. It might mean new or expanded rail service possibilities for businesses there.
Interesting local development. Okay, almost through the notices. We have one from the Federal Highway Administration about a bridge program and one from the U.S. Sentencing Commission about its priorities.
Bridges and sentencing. Quite a combo.
Right. First, the Federal Highway Administration, FHWA. This notice details the fiscal year 24 and 25 Competitive Highway Bridge Program, or CHBP. This program provides up to $500 million specifically for highway bridge replacement or rehabilitation projects across the country.
Half a billion for bridges. How is it allocated?
It's competitive, but eligibility criteria target states based on things like population density and the overall condition of their bridges. For example, states qualify if less than 26% of their bridge deck area is rated in good condition, or if more than 5.2% is in poor condition. States with very high percentages of poor bridges get a minimum allocation.
So directing funds where the problems are worst, is there a specific focus?
Yes. A key focus mentioned is that the program prioritizes projects that demonstrate cost savings by bundling multiple highway bridge projects together.
Ah, bundling. Yeah. Fixing several smaller bridges under one contract to save money.
Exactly. The notice also emphasizes accountability awardees have to execute project agreements with clear schedules and budgets and report quarterly on progress to ensure financial transparency.
This is a significant federal investment in critical infrastructure, isn't it? Directly tackling that widespread problem of aging and deteriorating bridges, which impacts safety and commerce all across the U.S.
A much-needed investment.
Absolutely. And that bundling requirement is a smart detail. It incentivizes states to be more efficient, grouping smaller projects to achieve economies of scale. It's about stretching those federal dollars further, getting more bridges fixed for the money, and the eligibility rules help ensure the aid goes to states facing the biggest challenges with their bridge inventory.
Good to see focus there. Now, the U.S. Sentencing Commission, This notice lays out their proposed priorities for the upcoming amendment cycle, ending May 1, 2026. These priorities guide changes to the federal sentencing guidelines that judges use. And significantly, the commission explicitly states it intends to consider reducing costs of incarceration and overcapacity of prisons in its work this cycle.
That's a noteworthy statement up front. What are the specific priorities?
Several key areas. One, providing clearer guidance to courts on choosing between imprisonment, probation, or fines the fundamental sentencing options. Two, a deep dive into drug trafficking offenses, particularly looking at
fentanyl, I bet.
Yes, specifically. Potential distinctions based on amphetamine purity, statutory changes related to fentanyl, sentencing enhancements for fentanyl offenses, other fentanyl-related issues, and possibly amending the chemical quantity table for fentanyl precursors.
A major focus on fentanyl and meth. What else?
Three, reviewing the guidelines for theft, property destruction, and fraud. They want to ensure these guidelines accurately reflect culpability and harm. This includes possibly reassessing the role of actual loss versus intended loss or gain, revising the complex loss table for simplicity or inflation, and considering the impact of adjustments based on victim characteristics or the defendant's role.
Trying to make fraud sentences more consistent and proportionate.
Seems like it. And finally, continuing to evaluate the career offender guidelines, possibly exploring alternative approaches to the current categorical approach through workshops and data analysis.
Okay, this is incredibly significant for the federal justice system. These priorities directly shape how federal judges sentence thousands of people every year for a wide range of federal crimes.
Setting the direction for sentencing policy.
Absolutely. That explicit focus on fentanyl, including precursors and enhancements, clearly reflects the urgency of the opioid crisis and how the government is trying to respond through the criminal justice system. And the review of theft and fraud guidelines, along with looking at sentencing options beyond prison, suggests a broader effort. They seem to be aiming for sentences that are proportionate to the actual harm caused, while also potentially exploring ways to address prison overcrowding and the high costs of incarceration. It signals a continued evolution in federal sentencing philosophy.
A lot of important work ahead for the Sentencing Commission. And one very last notice from the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA.
What's the VA notice about?
The VA is proposing to extend an information collection. This relates to clauses in its acquisition regulation, the VAAR, concerning indemnification and insurance requirements for contractors.
Making sure contractors have insurance.
Basically, yes. This collection ensures that contractors providing services to the VA maintain the required levels of insurance coverage. The purpose stated is vital, protecting both the VA and its beneficiaries, veterans, from potential negligent acts of the contractor or its employees.
This is a crucial, if perhaps mundane-sounding, administrative step, isn't it? It's about safeguarding veterans' interests. When outside contractors provide services, could be healthcare, IT support, facility maintenance, anything making sure they're adequately insured means that if something goes wrong because of the contractor's mistake, veterans are protected and there is a clear path for recourse.
Protects the veteran and the VA.
Exactly. It's also just good governance and fiscal responsibility. It helps prevent the VA and ultimately taxpayers from being left on the hook financially for contractor errors. It ensures liability rests where it should.
Makes perfect sense. Okay, that wraps up our look at the general notices. Now let's take a deep dive into one of the most substantial notices published today. This is a proposed antitrust settlement with major implications for home health, hospice care, and even the employment of nurses across the country. The case is captioned United States et al., United Health Group Incorporated et al.
Yes, this is a really significant case. It definitely underscores the government's intense focus on competition, especially in critical sectors like healthcare, where consolidation has been rampant. What we have here is the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, joined by multiple states, challenging a major proposed merger between two absolute giants in the home health and hospice space.
Let's break it down. What was the proposed merger, and why were the government and the states so concerned about it? What was the core challenge here?
Okay, so the companies involved are United Health Group, already a massive player in healthcare across many sectors.
Insurance, providers, pharmacy benefits, they're huge.
Huge. And relevant here, back in February 2023, United Health acquired LHC Group, which at the time was the nation's third largest home health provider and also a large hospice provider. Post-acquisition, LHC became the second largest home health provider nationally.
Okay, so United Health was already a top player via LHC.
Exactly. Then the other company is Amedisys. As of 2022, Amedisys was the largest home health and hospice company in the U.S.
Number one and number two potentially combining.
That was the plan. Just months after buying LHC Group, UnitedHealth announced its intention to acquire Amedisys in May 2023.
Okay, so the government stepped in. What was their main argument against the deal?
The core of the complaint filed by the DOJ and the states is that this proposed acquisition would violate Section 7 of the Clayton Act. That's the part of antitrust law prohibiting mergers and acquisitions that might substantially lessen competition or tend to create a monopoly.
And how would this merger lessen competition, according to the complaint?
The main concern was the elimination of what the complaint describes as fierce head-to-head competition between UnitedHealth, through LHC, and Amedisys. This competition was happening in hundreds of local markets across the country for both home health services and hospice services.
Okay, competition in local markets for patient services. What else?
The complaint argues this competition did several important things. It drove improvements in quality and service for patients. It helped control home health costs, particularly for Medicare Advantage plans where these companies negotiate rates. And significantly, it enhanced compensation and other employment terms for the nurses critical to providing care.
Ah, so they brought in the impact on the labor market too. That's interesting.
It's a key and really fascinating aspect of this case. The complaint explicitly states the merger threatens competition in the labor market specifically for home health and hospice nurses. They found evidence suggesting UnitedHealth viewed Amedisys as its biggest competition for recruiting and retaining nurses, even calling them the first line of attack.
So fewer options for nurses means potentially worse compensation or working conditions.
That's the argument. Nurses, many of whom prefer the specific nature of home health or hospice work, would be negatively impacted because the two largest employers in many areas would become one, reducing their bargaining power and competitive options.
Beyond the labor market, what about competition for patients?
The complaint details how both companies actively competed based on quality metrics, things like CMS star ratings, which patients and referring physicians look at. They competed on how quickly they could admit new patients, on offering specialized programs, like for veterans, dementia care, heart failure support, and on the number of clinician touch points or visits they provided. The concern is that smaller competitors often lack the scale and resources to invest and compete at that same level.
So the merger would remove that top-tier competition, potentially leading to lower quality or less innovation over time.
That's the fear. And based on the market shares the combined company would have in many local areas, the complaint argues the merger is presumptively anti-competitive and illegal under established antitrust standards. The concentration levels would simply be too high.
And there was another issue mentioned in the notice, right? A problem with Amedisys during the investigation.
Yes, that's layered on top. During the antitrust investigation, the DOJ issued what's called a second request to Amedisys. This is a standard but very burdensome demand for vast amounts of documents and data relevant to the merger review.
Okay.
The complaint alleges that Amedisys violated a different part of the law, Section 7A of the Clayton Act, part of the Hart-Scott-Rodino Act. They alleged Amedisys provided an erroneous and inaccurate certification when it claimed it had fully complied with the second request. Amedisys certified compliance twice, but the plaintiffs contend the response was not actually accurate or complete at those times.
So potentially hindering the investigation itself.
That's the allegation. So given all this, the alleged harm to competition for services, for nurse labor, the presumptive illegality based on market concentration, and the alleged HSR Act violation, the plaintiffs were seeking a court order to block the merger entirely, issue a permanent injunction, and potentially force divestitures.
Okay, so that was the lawsuit. But this notice is about a settlement, a consent decree. They reached an agreement to avoid a full trial.
Mm-hmm.
What are the key terms of this proposed settlement? How are they trying to fix the competitive problems?
Right. The proposed final judgment, which is the formal settlement document, lays out detailed remedies specifically designed to restore the competition that the government believes would be lost by the merger. The centerpiece is divestiture.
Selling off assets.
Yes. Significant divestitures. UnitedHealth is required to divest, meaning sell off, certain divestiture assets, specific home health and hospice agencies in numerous overlapping markets to one or more approved buyers. This has to happen within 75 calendar days after the court approves the settlement.
Okay. Selling off overlapping businesses. Is there anything unusual about these divestitures?
Yes, there's a really interesting and quite intricate provision dealing with what they call sharing locations. It turns out 6 of the home health locations that United Health needs to divest currently share licenses, or CMS provider identification numbers, with other locations that United Health will be allowed to keep.
That sounds complicated. How do you split those?
Exactly. It creates a potential problem. If the company buying the divested sharing location can't get its own separate licenses and regulatory approvals needed to operate independently, or if they can't get set up to bill Medicare and Medicaid properly,
then the divestiture doesn't really restore competition.
Precisely. So the decree has a backup plan. If the acquirers of these sharing locations run into those kinds of regulatory roadblocks and can't operate them effectively within 18 months unless the DOJ grants an extension, then United Health is required to divest up to 8 additional home health locations.
Wow. So a penalty or alternative divestiture if the first ones don't work out cleanly.
Exactly. It's a strong mechanism to ensure the buyers actually get viable, independent businesses that can compete effectively from day one. It shows the DOJ was thinking ahead about potential implementation problems.
What else does United Health have to do to make these divestitures work?
They have to use their best efforts to help the buyer. The tree names potential buyers like BrightSpring and Pennant or another DOJ-approved entity get all the necessary regulatory approvals, licenses, registrations, permits. They also have to help transfer contracts, patient relationships, referral sources, basically hand over the business as a going concern.
And what about the staff, especially those nurses they competed for?
That's addressed too. United Health must help the buyers identify and hire the relevant personnel currently working at the divested locations. This includes providing organizational charts, detailed info on job titles, compensation, benefits, all within 10 days of a request from the buyer. They have to facilitate the transfer of employees who want to go with the divested business,
making sure the workforce can transition smoothly.
Right. And another critical, often complex detail in healthcare deals, the electronic health record, or EHR system. United Health uses a system called Home Care Homebase. The decree requires them to make best efforts to transition all the patient data and operational functions for the divested assets from their system to the acquirer's system within 240 days of the sale. That's a huge IT challenge, but essential for the buyer to operate independently.
Absolutely. So divestitures, help with approvals, personnel transfer, EHR transition. How does the government make sure all this actually happens correctly?
Through strong oversight mechanisms built into the decree. First, if United Health fails to complete the divestitures within the 75-day timeframe, the court will appoint a divestiture trustee. This trustee, chosen by the U.S. government but paid by United Health, would have the authority to sell the assets themselves. The trustee's compensation is structured to incentivize selling quickly and for the best possible price.
So a backup seller if needed.
Exactly. Second, the U.S. also has the option to appoint a monitoring trustee. This monitor's job would be to oversee United Health's compliance with the entire consent decree, ensuring the divestitures happen properly, the data migration goes smoothly, personnel transfers are facilitated, any required transition services are provided correctly. The monitor reports back to the DOJ and also serves at United Health's expense.
So multiple layers of oversight.
Yes. And there's also a requirement for a detailed compliance plan for any United Health employees who might be involved in providing temporary transition services to the buyers. These are called firewall employees. The plan has to ensure they don't access or misuse any competitively sensitive data related to the divested assets still lingering in United Health systems. This includes training, written acknowledgments, technical controls to segregate data, and tracking access.
Thorough, and the public gets a say.
Yes. As required by the Tunney Act for antitrust settlements, the public has 30 days from the publication of this notice in the Federal Register to submit comments on the proposed consent decree to the Department of Justice. People can even request a public meeting. The DOJ will consider these comments before asking the court for final approval of the settlement.
Okay, this consent decree, it really seems like a masterclass in antitrust remedies, doesn't it? It's not just saying no to the merger. It's incredibly detailed in trying to recreate the competition that would have been lost.
It really is. Those details around the sharing locations and the backup divestiture requirement, that shows the DOJ anticipating potential pitfalls and building in solutions to ensure the remedy is actually effective.
Yeah.
You don't always see that level of contingency planning.
And the focus on nurse employment? That feels significant, too.
Hugely significant. Treating the labor market as a distinct area where a merger can harm competition is a major point here. It sets a precedent that antitrust enforcers are looking not just at consumer prices, but also at how consolidation affects workers' wages, benefits, and opportunities. That's a big deal, especially in healthcare, where labor is such a critical input.
It's striking how comprehensive it is, right down to the EHR system transition. That alone is a massive operational challenge, and mandating it in the decree just underscores the complexity of trying to disentangle these huge healthcare conglomerates once they merge.
Absolutely. And the roles for the divestiture trustee and the monitor, they show the government isn't just issuing an order and walking away. They're putting mechanisms in place to actively oversee compliance and make sure the spirit of the antitrust laws protecting competition is actually upheld in practice.
So for anyone out there receiving home health or hospice care, or maybe working as a nurse or therapist in these fields, this settlement has very direct, real-world implications. It affects the choices available to them, the quality of services, maybe even their job opportunities and compensation.
Without a doubt, it's a clear signal from antitrust enforcers. They are watching healthcare consolidation very closely, especially in vital, growing sectors like home health and hospice care as our population ages. And it powerfully highlights that competition isn't just about lower prices for consumers. It's also about quality of care, access to services, innovation in delivery, and ensuring fair wages and conditions for the healthcare professionals we all rely on.
A really impactful case and settlement. Wow, what a journey through today's Federal Register. We went from, you know, the seemingly small details of crop insurance regulations and airplane parts,
to the sweeping implications of a presidential order potentially taking control of a major city's police force.
And this monumental antitrust battle, reshaping a huge part of the healthcare industry. It really demonstrates how interconnected and truly impactful these daily government publications can be.
It absolutely does. We saw regulations adapting or trying to adapt to new technologies, like those ORVR systems in cars making gas station vapor recovery partly obsolete, or exchanges grappling with how to handle Bitcoin ETFs.
We explored the deep complexities of reporting international trade data and the profound ethical and cultural importance of laws like NECGPRA, ensuring the repatriation of Native American ancestors and artifacts.
And we got insights into how the government works proactively trying to help communities recover from disasters like wildfires, ensuring contractors are insured, cleaning up old FOIA requests, maintaining the integrity of our financial markets through clearinghouse oversight.
So thinking about all this, what does it really mean for you, our listener, trying to stay informed?
Well, I think it means that understanding these underlying mechanisms, seeing how decisions are made, how regulations are implemented, how challenges are addressed through things like antitrust settlements or FAA directives, provides a crucial lens. It helps you view the daily news headlines with more depth.
Right. It's not just about what happens, but how and why it happens, and the specific details that really define the impact on the ground.
Yeah.
Seeing the machinery at work.
Exactly. And looking forward, it raises a really important question, doesn't it? As technology keeps accelerating, as society faces ever more complex challenges like climate change or pandemics or economic shifts, how nimble, how adaptive can our regulatory frameworks really be?
Can the rulemaking process keep pace?
Can it keep pace effectively? And maybe even more importantly, how can citizens, how can you best stay informed and participate meaningfully in a process that is often so detailed, so complex, yet so incredibly impactful on almost every aspect of your daily life?
That is a powerful thought to leave everyone with. We certainly hope this deep dive into the August 14th, 2025 Federal Register has given you plenty to mull over and maybe even inspired you to do some digging of your own into the areas that affect you most. Thank you for joining us on the deep dive.
Thank you for listening.
I'm Alex Smith.
And I'm Taylor Johnson.
And we'll be back soon with another deep dive.